Fernando Mendez is a relationship and dating coach who helps women across the world find lasting love by understanding the masculine mindset, building self-worth, and creating genuine romantic connection. Through his coaching program, and I have to say, amazing online resources at burnmendez.com, he empowers women to release limiting beliefs and navigate the emotional dynamics of dating with clarity and confidence. With a background in diplomacy and personal development, Fernando brings a grounded, emotionally intelligent perspective to love and intimacy with a focus on long-term partnership and soulful alignment. When you finish listening to his talk, don't rush off now, you have to check out Bern's incredible YouTube channel with 30 million views. I'm incredibly jealous. 901 videos and hours of amazing content. It is a treasure trove of actionable insight. I started looking at some of your stuff earlier in the week, and I looked at the clock, an hour and a half had gone by. I just kept clicking on things, which is good, I guess, is what you want. It's very, very, it really draws you back. First of all, thank you so much for joining us. You're incredibly kind to give us your time.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
I think it's a super important topic. I think love, relationships, happiness is what we're here for, really. But I wanted to take you back a little bit, if that's okay. Sure. Just to understand what your formative years were like. Could the person you were then recognize the person you are today? Is there a close association? What was the sort of path that you followed?
I think anyone who is really into something, anyone who is honest about it, at least in my life experience, there's some level of pain that brought them to attempt to solve a big dilemma or challenge, you know, yeah. Whether it's a chef, you know, or whether it's a therapist. For me specifically, I am someone who was born and raised in Mexico City, very sensitive heart from a very young age. And very, I'd say, my attachment style from an early age became more anxious than not. I mean, through life experiences. Yeah. And I found myself at the age of 17, very depressed and not knowing how to change it. And part of that depression came from me wanting connection, me wanting to be loved by someone other than my parents, mm-hmm. and not knowing how to do it and falling for people who would be great to have me as a friend, but not necessarily as a partner. And it came to a halt at one point. And my mom was wise enough to find some help for me. And when I found kind of like the light at the end of that tunnel in a way that was different from what I expected, it wasn't therapy, it was just coaching mm-hmm. that I experienced then. I felt a strong calling to say, well, if this is something that's helping me right now, how can I use some of this to help other people who are facing something similar? So that started my early journey of figuring out my own stuff and also a deep journey to help others who are suffering in some way.
It is amazing, and you're so right. So many people I've talked to on this podcast have had some form of setback or trauma or difficulty or in their lives that they've then sort of thought, hey, I got through this, how maybe can I help other people, what can I do? And it's you never want people to have gone through anything in the beginning, but you are very grateful, I'm very grateful that people then decide to actually take on board the responsibility to help and guide other people, really. I know one of the things that you worked in was diplomacy.
I think that's not true. Not the policy. I worked in some startups, and I worked I ran a few businesses before this, but I wish I were a diplomat.
How did you enjoy working in startups? Was that sort of literally from the ground up, you sort of dived in and
needed to be done? Always enjoyed entrepreneurship. I think that's one of the things that I saw. My grandfather was an entrepreneur. My dad was an entrepreneur. Yeah. And I was doing this really cool project with my two brothers. And we met some people who had started a really successful company. These two brothers from Mexico started this really successful company. And they grew it to, I think, they sold it for hundreds of millions of dollars, and they were our age, and they said, hey, we're having this cool project, do you want to participate? And it's like, sure, I'll participate. So that was my invitation to that, and it was cool. It was a project that involved different countries and involved helping bring payment products to the underserved. So it's a really exciting thing. At the end of the day, it wasn't my thing. It was really exciting to be there, but I felt this calling to, okay, when are you going to do your thing, you know? And it took my father dying for me to say, okay, Now I'm going to do it. And now's the time.
And what was your sort of first almost formal step into helping create genuine romantic connections and helping people?
My first steps were really back in the day when I was 17. I started traveling with his mentor, different, mostly in the US, but sometimes Canada and other places, and learning how do you help someone who maybe has had a lifetime of doing things a certain way to see things from a different perspective and to create changes and to have a strategy that goes beyond just looking at your past. So that was the beginning. Yeah. So from an early age, I would come back to Mexico and I give my own little workshop to my friends. And then I would expand beyond my friends to maybe some strangers, friends of friends. And then when I moved to the States, I started helping people in a juvenile delinquent center. I have a twin brother. So we create a little program to help them figure out some, I mean, what's going on with their lives and how to make it better. So it was always a graduation of sorts. It wasn't specifically directed towards intimacy because I knew nothing about intimacy at that stage. But I did have this calling to figure out, okay, if you've been doing things a certain way, is there a different insight or a different mindset or a different experience that can give you another way of doing things and change? So that was the whole thing. And then at some point in life, I started studying more, just like what creates a successful couple and what creates intimacy. And it was really organic. I launched my YouTube program many, many years ago with the idea of just helping people. It was more of a life coaching tilt. And through many conversations, I'd have conversations like people who were listening to my videos were women. I didn't set out to have women related themes, but those are the people who were listening to my podcast I had a podcast back in the day to my videos, and then lots of conversations and across the pain points, this thing kept coming up. I mean, somebody successful, happy, friendships, but love is not in the cards for her, or relationships. She keeps going back to someone who's not good for her. So that really gave me a big bird's eye view into, okay, this is a big challenge. And how do we use some of the tools that I've already cultivated for a few years and apply them specifically in intimacy? Obviously, more learning had to take place. Yep. But some of the things that you can apply to intimacy, you can apply to playing tennis better, you know? Mm-hmm. So I started with the things that I knew, and mm-hmm. then it was a great learning experience, and also going back to the drawing board and studying more to see what creates success in partnerships.
Mm. It's funny, isn't it? Well, often when we are looking for a partner or open to a partner, if you sort of thought about it rationally, we don't really go about it in a very scientific way. we either meet a friend introduced to somebody, we might go to a bar, we might even go on an app or whatever. But compared to so many other things that we do, if you're buying a new car or a new stereo or a new phone, we spend so much time researching, investigating, comparing, but dating, we seem to, I don't know, we think it should almost happen organically. And there were three things and three forces you talk about, and I wanted to go through them if that's okay.
Sure.
So you talked about understanding attraction blind spots. So what is an attraction blind spot?
An attraction blind spot is precisely what you're talking about right now. It's when you tend to go for a type,
okay,
or you tend to be attracted to someone, mm-hmm, or to a series of people who have a common denominator, and maybe the common denominator is not just fun and flirty and passionate, but also not good for you. Mm. So attraction blind spot is, what is it that's causing you to consistently go for the type of human that will precisely deliver the opposite of what your heart needs to feel at peace or to feel loved or to feel seen? Because one of the things that, again, wisely you're sharing is, most of us don't necessarily go out looking for a partner with a great deal of insight into what we're going for and how to identify it. Mm-hmm. But it's more of a chemistry thing. I mean, a lot of people fall in love, but it's just their biochemistry reacting strongly to someone who they feel really passionate about. And it's so easy to confuse feeling really attracted to someone to being in love with that person. And the moment you think you're in love with that person, I mean, you take a brain scan. I mean, they've done studies where they take a brain scan of someone who is in love, freshly into a relationship, and someone who's doing cocaine, and there's no visible difference in the way the way it's operating, you know, the neurochemicals being released, the obsessiveness taking place, the lowering of serotonin, which makes you more obsessive. So all those things take place. And so attraction blinds, but really is what is it that you're doing that's not serving you, and how can we do it slightly differently?
It's hard, isn't it? Because I mean, this is so sort of facile almost to say. But if you say, well, my type is, you know, I prefer tall and blonde and face and blah blah blah, and I say, well, there's this really gorgeous, cute girl and brunette over here. Oh, that's not my type at all. It's such a silly thing to say, not my type, because what are you purely looking at? Are you going to look? Are you purely going on height? Are you purely going on the hair color? and I wonder why we have that, whether it's something that it's somebody maybe we're attracted to at a young age and didn't even realize, it's a relative we first maybe had a crush on or something, or it's, I don't know, whether we go back to that thing. It's almost trying to fix something that happened to us previously.
For sure. I think there's many aspects of it. I mean, part of it is biological. I mean, there's going to be things that create a stronger sense of pull for some people, even pheromones. I mean, you can actually smell in potential partner if they would be a good match for your offspring, and that's something that's so subconscious, but sometimes that has a strong influence in how people connect. There's also the what you were talking about earlier in life, right? If you experience chaos in your house, and that is the definition of intimacy, and then you connect with someone, and there's this part of your brain that's so smart and detects chaos in that person, you don't think of it that way. You think they're just magnificent and really fun, but somehow it's not despite the chaos, it's because of it that you're choosing that person. And then lo and behold, you connect with that human being. And after the intense first 2-3 months, problems arise. But by that point, you're very, very attached to that human being. And it's hard to let go. So it's just one of those repeating cycles. But it's sometimes related to that thermostat that gets set at a certain temperature, and if we don't evaluate and reset it, then we're going for the same thing and think that we're going for something else. No, it's like the phrase by Carl Jung, if you don't make the unconscious conscious, it will run your life and you'll call it fate. And that's what happens for many of us.
Yeah, a lot of my friends, a lot of girlfriends I have will say, oh, I never seem to attract the same sort of person. I never seem to attract the right person. And yeah, exactly what you're saying. It's almost the aura or whatever you're putting out into the world, isn't it? It's not an attraction or not attraction. It's just that you're not allowing yourself to see the signs and something else. You're not allowing yourself to pick up another key, as you're just sort of being drawn back to that same kind of person. And is that reflected a lot in the second thing you talk about, which is the importance of self-love? Because I think a lot of people, when you ask them, wouldn't necessarily say that they truly love themselves.
I think that self-love is such an active verb, you know, and it's often confused with some more cosmetic experiences in life. I think for some people, self-love is getting a massage every week. And for some people, self-love is looking very pretty or very handsome. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong. I mean, I'm not saying that's not part of it. I think self-love at the deepest level is loving yourself even in the worst of your moments, forgiving yourself for the things that you think you should have done but didn't do, and taking an active, very proactive stance into your mental health, which doesn't sound sexy or doesn't sound loving. But without that aspect of things, if your hardwiring is not working properly, you're not going to be able to pull it off. I mean, you can't white knuckle your way through self-love. So sometimes some of the most basic things and most boring things, like Mr. Miyagi, walks on, walks off, and paint the fence. I mean, some of those things are self-love. You know, wake up in the morning and not looking at the news is self-love. Taking a walk in nature is self-love. Saying no thanks when somebody's offering a bad offer emotionally or love-wise, and you feel really compelled because it feels so exciting in the moment, but you know it's not good for you. That's a lot of self-love. So self-love comes in different shapes and forms, and it's not for me to judge which one is better. I just know from my experience of helping others that there's a big component that's not necessarily talked about enough, which has to do with mental health and with self-forgiveness. Because if that's in place, including also having a relationship with the younger version of you or different parts in you, all of that makes up for a healthy, sustainable, very practical, non-new age self-love.
No, I like that. Yeah. I wanted to come back to the third element you talk about, but just to talk a little bit about.
Sure.
One of the challenges I think we have in society now, and we talked a little bit about where we are in society before we hit record, that is that I'm not sure that men necessarily understand what masculinity is all about. And I'm not necessarily sure women completely understand what sort of man that they want. And it feels that we're both a bit confused as to what, as to who we are and who we're not. Men have, you know, been responsible for some very traumatic events. Men have sort of been told that, look, you need to do this, don't be like this, do be like this. Women are told, you should do this, shouldn't do this, could do this. And it feels that maybe 50 years ago, I'm not saying it was right at all, but it was much clearer. So men, women. Whereas now it's much, much more of a blend. So what are the things do you think that women should want or do want from men, and what masculinity looks like in a relationship? That's a big question. So I'm going to ask them.
So I'll answer this into parts. I mean, I'll talk about a study that was done first time 1989 by David Voss, and that basically evaluated what people want in partnerships. And they asked women, what are you looking for in a man?
Yeah.
You know, and one of the highest responses from 37 countries, in no matter how successful the woman was or if she had kids or not, was a man who can be protective, you know? So they said, well, I mean, that's 30 years ago or whatever. They did the same thing in, I think it was 2022, in now 45 countries, and the same result came up, you know? Now, the challenge with that, and I'm very specific about it, is that for some people, if you go back to the old age of men and women, being protective means telling you what to do and when to stay in the house and what type of dress to wear, because I'm protecting you. It's like control with the guise of it's for your interests, you know? But I think right now, at least in my thousands of conversations with women who are single, that protection comes from a protection of the heart. Figuring out who that person is, like being seen, being felt, being able to express themselves without the fear of judgment, having someone who can be there in times of challenge and be strong, not strong in the sense of not feeling, but strong in the sense of being able to be capable of coming up with if solutions at times, but sometimes just the experience of holding space for someone. And I think that we get very confused this day and age with the Andrew Tates of the world, you know, on the internet, the way it is, with men misunderstanding that with, of course, to be a strong man, I must be, it's just my way or the highway, and I must demean women. And so that's, I think, that the challenging place we're in right now, where a lot of men are very confused about where they are in the world, fewer friends than ever, higher suicide rates than ever, lower unemployment, and all, I think the income basically finally changing, starting to change between men and women, more college-educated women by far these days than men. So there's this feeling of, oh my God, I don't have what I used to have, so I must come back strong and be that a-hole, you know, that we used to be at times, just to be able to, and that's the challenge. I think a lot of women are hoping for men to show up with a combination of two things: capacity to make things happen, but also capacity to hold space and emotionally attuned to their needs, so that it's not just okay, go out and kill the tiger for me, but let's talk about it. I think that the way relationships work these days have foundationally changed from what we expected before. So we want so much more now. And we want sometimes polar opposites of the things we want, you know, safety and adventure. And we want intimacy, but we want independence. So like, it's one of those things that without taking a step back and maybe getting together, you know, men and women, and having conversations that are not just black and white and talking points, it's not going to lead to a good place. At the same time, there's more possibilities now than ever in order to create a relationship that was much more fulfilling in different ways than before. But the problem, and you said this earlier, I think most people feel like love should be natural, and love, the feeling, is the most natural thing in the world. That's what we are love. The experience of deep intimacy is the craziest adventure we've ever invented. Never have has it happened in human history? I mean, think about it. And so now it's possible, but without the skills, it's one of those things that you can look at in a, I don't know, as a high goal, but it's, we're not going to reach there. So we need to figure out how to learn those skills, so we have a shot of that high experience of intimacy that we seek.
That's a really good answer. And I think, I was just thinking then, as you were talking about my grandparents.
Yeah.
So this is literally two generations ago.
Yeah.
So they were part of the Second World War, and my grandfather was a coal miner. My grandfather sort of lived at home, looked after the three sons that they had, and the sort of strength that he had was very much sort of physical strength and the ability to put money on the table at the end of the week.
Yeah.
The thoughts of asking him to be more vulnerable, I just don't think not with any ill intent towards him at all, but I just don't think he would have even answered the word. Yeah. So I think it's that he said to somebody, look, actually being vulnerable and being able to show your vulnerability is an incredible strength. And this is literally two generations ago. So all these things that we are experiencing, desiring, have come about almost within a sort of second of human being around. All this time beforehand was all very, very clear, very, very clear. Not necessarily good, but all very clear. And then suddenly almost you've had these couple of seconds that actually, well, here's what you need to be and here's what you need to do. And it's still, I just think it's still evolving quite a bit.
It's happened quickly and without a lot of, here's how we change things. So we have you can log into Instagram and see fake images of people madly in love and feel very dissonant with, well, that I don't have that, so I envy it, right? You don't know that those people are fighting before and after that picture, but it seems like they have a perfect relationship.
Yeah.
But now we have the highest, because of the internet, we have the highest, almost like a gap between what we think is possible and what we're experiencing without the, okay, but I agree with you, my grandfather, my grandma, I can see that relationship. My grandmother didn't learn how to drive. She stayed in the house. She had somebody who helped her. I mean, because in Mexico you have servants, but she was in charge of the household. And my grandfather was in charge of, he was a musician, he was a composer, he was friends of the president. So he would go on party and do these things and come back home and bring the money. But their life experiences were not equal. It was not an equal opportunity experience for both. My parents, different experience, you know, my mom worked, my dad worked. Again, it was more even. But still, I mean, I think that if I look back into what they experienced, there's elements of that I love, and there's elements that I want more deeply than what they experienced. So we keep raising the bar in terms of expectations, you know?
Yeah. How quickly do people realize whether something is going to become a relationship or not? So when you counsel your clients and you support them and you talk to them and you engage them, go through the plan, they go on a date, they meet, they meet for coffee, they go again a few days later, maybe for dinner. How quickly do you know whether it's something worth pursuing? That sounds so cold, but do you know what I mean?
Because
you
don't,
if you're 35, 40, 45, 50, you don't necessarily want to spend 6 months and I knew this was never going to work from the beginning. How quickly do you know that something isn't worth
it? I mean, that's why guidance is important. I think if you have guidance and you're self-regulating powerfully and you understand your attachment style and you understand how to vet people more powerfully without making it an interrogation, then more quickly than not. Now, the thing, so what I would say is it's easier if you understand some things, how to know if something is totally not worth pursuing. It's harder sometimes when the more chemistry there is, the harder it, the more it acts like a blinding agent.
Yeah, it masks,
you know?
Yeah.
So, but I think that it really comes down to having the capacity to have open-ended conversations about things that actually matter. You know, so I'll give you an example, something very practical. When I guide my clients in terms of going on dates, you have someone who's really active. Maybe she has children and she also has a job, and it's a demanding job. It's not just any job. So she doesn't have unlimited spots in her week for dates.
Yeah.
So if she connects with someone online, let's say on a dating app, and they kind of hit it off and they just meet in person, she might experience 4 hours of her life she's never going to get back, but half an hour to get ready, half an hour to get there, 2 hours at the place, or two and a half, and then going back, and then it was a bad experience. So there's sometimes you can't eliminate the risk of that being a bad experience, but you can reduce the risk. So let's say instead of doing that, you have a video conversation with someone for 10 minutes. And on that video call, you notice the person is maybe 15 years different in appearance than their picture.
Yes.
They have an energy or a vibe that gives you the creeps, for example. And it's just something that safety-wise, you don't feel like you want to connect with that human being. So you could say after 15 minutes, thank you so much, I appreciate being here, and not go on the date. So that would eliminate, if you do that throughout multiple dating experiences, you go fewer dates, but you go better quality ones. Now, what happens when you do pass that filter and you go into that date and you talk about things that matter? You talk about fun things, but you also ask the person, hey, tell me a bit more about what are you looking for in a relationship these days? And maybe the guy will say, I'm looking for something serious. Great, me too. Tell me, what does that mean to you? You know, open-ended. And then get a chance to figure out if that's something that's within the vicinity or the planet that they're both going to. Because what happens if you have the same question and you don't ask it on the first date or before the first date, and it's date number 10, and then you, what are you looking for? Well, right now I'm a little confused and I'm going through this breakup thing. And you already invested 10 dates of your life and feeling more attached to that person, creating fantasies in your head. So I think that the sooner you are able to ask important questions while not making it a checklist, because that can also throw off people. If you, it's an art. How do you connect with people, get the best communication going, and also find out really important things so that at every step of the way, you can figure out what's possible. Another thing that's really helpful in discovering if somebody is worth experiencing a relationship with or not is inevitably something will be a disagreement. There's going to be things that are green and yellow and they're not seeing eye to eye. How does that person solve it? When you have a need and you express it, can the person rise to the challenge and say, hey, you know what? I see it differently, but I'm still able to step up. Or will the person put it back on you and say, hey, that's your problem? And so there's going to be lots of little points, almost like little testing grounds that as people progress through them, you make it less and less likely that the person's going to be a waste of time for both of you, and more likely that the person's relationship ready for something to explore. Mm. Something else that's important to do is to have the capacity to date more than one person at a time. That's something I believe in, because what happens when you connect with someone and you only date that one person? They're your boyfriend or girlfriend from day one. And sometimes it doesn't work out. And if that's the only thing you have going on, then you have to start again from scratch.
Yeah.
So it extends the cycle into how long it's going to take for you to find that person. You can't do it indefinitely. You can't have, I mean, you can, but I mean, you can't do 10 guys at a time. Having more than one person, maybe two people that you're exploring things with, I think might make some sense.
Hmm. Yeah, I had a friend, and she was in a relationship for 2 years before she realized that the person she was with never wanted to have children. And I'm talking to her, I said, well, did it? Yeah, I mean, he was always so good with my nieces and nephews. So, well, because he could hand them back. That was, I always thought he did. He never talked about it, just assumed. And then that was obviously, that was a deal breaker for her, deal breaker for him. And that was 2 years. Yeah. And a lot of emotional commitment just had to pull apart. But if they'd had that discussion fairly early on,
Yeah, and that discussion can be, so there's two things. Sometimes people change their minds, which is valid. Yeah. But sometimes what happens if you ask, I mean, if that's a deal breaker for you, before the first date, you could even ask that, hey, what are your thoughts on children? Not would you want to have children with me, but you know what? I love children, but they're not for me. Like, why go on the first date if that's something that's vitally important for you? So I know it's, you can't ask 30 questions like that, but if that's something that's really important, maybe one or two questions will probably save both of you a lot of time and heartache.
Yeah. And how important and how quickly does emotional alignment come about? So you might be physically attracted to one another. You might have some views on things, whether it's some views on politics, on children, on family, whatever. So how quickly does the emotional alignment come into play?
I think it's like a dance. It starts early on, and then it gets more and more beautiful and more rhythmic and more. But you can have that experience with someone from the first date. I'm not saying that you should have it or that has to be there from the first date, because sometimes people are nervous. But there's there needs to be some sense of there's something here, which is why I recommend for people to talk about fun things, but also have at least one question that inspires vulnerability. And how does a person open up? Is a person sharing a little bit more? Are you sharing a little bit more? I think that's something that can happen from early on, but it's not going to be a complete yes or no until more time has passed. Why? Because sometimes people show up with the best version of themselves for the first couple of dates, and then they start going down. Yeah. So there's no factor that can eliminate or can replace the time part of the equation.
Yeah.
But the quality of the communication, the quality of the attunement within that experience, it's something that you can start gauging from the beginning. Is a person really interested in listening to you? When you talk, how do you feel? When you share something, this or that, what is the heartfelt experience of that person really be? Are they asking questions just based on a checklist or based on what's happening? When you ask a question of this, are they responding in a way that is canned answer, or you can sense something that their heart is kind of being moved and they're, so I think that's something you gauge from the beginning, but it's something that cultivates and grows with time. And just like chemistry can grow, emotional attunement and the ability to gauge each other's emotional capacity is going to be something that's going to be tested, you know, throughout many experiences, and not just dinners, but going out in nature, meeting with friends and seeing how they connect with other people. There's so many different points that can give you a sense of that person's capacity for empathy, for kindness, for compassion, how they talk to themselves, how they talk to people in service. Like all those little points will inform, like, okay, is this person someone that I can be relational with?
And one of the things you talked about in your third point around developing an attuned dating plan is, and I really like this, was about creating scenarios where you're putting yourself in the best possible position or place to meet good people.
Yeah.
If you could, yeah, share a little bit about that.
Yeah, there's a couple of ways to do that. I mean, I think I have nothing against dating apps other than if you only use them at the exclusion of other things, you will feel burnt out. I'm doing a research right now project.
Yeah.
And one of the, statistics that woke me up a little bit. I know this empirically, but the statistic is they followed a certain number of women on dating apps. Mm-hmm. And by week number 12, they were experiencing, they weren't doing dating apps. They started doing dating apps. They didn't have any guidelines. They were just using them as most people do without just the app is open. They get pinged throughout the day. Mm-hmm. By week number 12, they were experiencing the same level of burnout than nurses at ICUs experience, you know? So when I say put yourself in the best places, like curate rooms, is if you just rely on the apps, your experience of life is going to be worse, not better. And if you don't get because some apps work better than others, and at different age groups, they work better than others. If you don't get enough hits or people liking you, you're going to be in pain. Like the same part of the brain that experiences rejection from society experiences physical pain. So it's physically painful energetically to have someone reject you. You know, you reach out to someone and they don't respond back. So doing the curation of rooms, the right room strategy is what I call it, is putting yourself in places where the room is doing half the filtering for you. If you go to a bar, basically, you'll get a certain crowd. If you go to a personal development event, you know, or a meditation event, it's a different crowd. I mean, the room is filtrating certain values that are making it more likely, depending upon what you're into, to meet the right kind of partner there. Plus, if you go to a place where part of the experience of that room is to communicate and to engage in conversation, then they have to talk to you. Versus being at a grocery store where it feels more like if I don't talk to this person, I'll never see them again. And it's high pressure and it's more awkward. It can happen. Happened many times for clients of mine. They meet someone at a parking lot, or they meet someone at the laundry cleaner. But certain rooms give you the ability to have more consistency and create more of a space for people to connect in meaningful conversations. And it's easier for a guy, for example, to ask you out as a woman if they're, you're sitting next to them and you're already talking, than if you're far away in a different part of the room and you're strangers. So it's, and the energy that you go into that room matters, because if there's a side of you that's more burnt out and cynical and jaded, go into that room, and the part of you that's more optimistic and connected to your light and expressive, you're going to have a very different experience. You know, what you focus on, who you are. And, you know, Rumi used to say, who you are shouts so loudly at my being, I cannot hear what you're saying. That is very true in the area of connection and resonance. If you go out and your thought is all guys are this or all women are this, you'll be proven right.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me just pose two scenarios to you. So somebody comes to you and they're 35 and they say, look, I've just had lots of short-term relationships, or 6 months, 9 months, it never seems to work out. I'm not sure what I'm doing wrong. And then somebody else comes to you, they're maybe 50, they've been through a divorce, and have been with their husband for the last 25 years, haven't dated anybody, and they're just terrified to get back into the dating scene. How do you handle those two different different challenges?
Yeah, I mean, some challenges are different, mm-hmm. but the same. Yeah. So it depends on the individual, really. I think that, because generically right now I could say, well, I would do this or that. But if the person, for example, that's 35 is more of an avoidant attachment style, then I would deal with it differently than if they're anxious attached, for example. But if both come from a place of I'm starting again and I don't know where to start, then both, I would start the same way with both. It would mean, let's take a step back. Let's stop dating for a second. Let's figure out what do you really want. Let's figure out what you've been going for and also why you've been going for it. Because it's something to, when your brain understands things, it doesn't necessarily mean you've changed them, but now it's like when you see the Wizard of Oz and there's this guy in the little room. I mean, you can see the thing there, but it's not scary anymore, right? Yeah. And a lot of what I do with my clients is help them understand what's really going on behind the curtain so they don't have a sense of shame for where they are. I think there's a lot of pressure for women specifically to define their success through relationships in ways that are not so strongly imposed on men. Mm-hmm. And because basically we have this idea that things should happen naturally, and I have a great job and I have that, but I haven't had that, then there's a feeling of there's something wrong with me. So when you can help someone understand in a very clear way, here's why it's happening and here's why your nervous system is trying to protect you, not hurt you. Let's just teach it differently so that you can now go for something that's real protection instead of this thing that you've learned to maladapt yourself to. Then we do a bunch of things, from helping that person to reconnect to a sense of well-being and aliveness and passion, to figuring out what it is that they really want. You know, that's where you get a chance to tweak. I mean, people have two types of lists when I talk to them. The overt list, which they feel happy to share on a podcast, like I want somebody who's kind and gentle and strong moral values and all those things. And then they want somebody secretly also who is 6 feet tall. And I want this guy to have this number of dollars in his bank account, like all those things that are more secretive and more cosmetic in nature. I'm not saying they're not important. I'm saying they're less relevant than the character of a person. So when we get a chance to figure out, okay, here's what we're going for. How do we go for the type of person that will really serve you versus the type of person you've taught yourself or trained yourself to go for? It may be a different person. And then with a different radar, then when somebody's feeling better, understands their patterns more, they have a way to regulate, then we can test it again and say, okay, let's go out there with this new map, with this new sense of being, and let's just see what's possible. And then on the go, they'll experience, they'll have good experiences and painful experiences. And my principle is, how do I guide them to make better decisions along the way so that they can get what they want? So they can rewire themselves on the go. This is the type of guy that I find boring. Okay, go on another date, please. Second date, it's a little bit better. Third date, he's amazing. Okay, but if they have maybe left it to their own devices, maybe they would have said at the first date, he's out, he's not my type.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that, I'm obviously having a conversation. It's not a do this or else. It's how do you help someone to see what they're not seeing so they can experience more? Same thing, somebody's connected with them and they feel so, I found my guy. Like, really, you found your guy? Tell me more. And he's just everything that I've been looking for. Everything. Wow, he's been a date. So how do you know that it's everything, you know? How do you help someone slow down so they don't do something that they'll regret a month later? So it's so when you help someone slow down or give somebody a chance, they start experiencing something different. And once they experience it, it's like the beautiful quote by, it's a paraphrasing of the quote by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, you know, like if you teach somebody to, don't teach somebody to build a ship by drumming up wood, teach them to long for the immensity of the sea. Like when you have someone who goes out and experiences being seen and felt different, or somebody that they thought he's just boring and he's really interesting,
yeah,
you don't have to convince them to, like they want to continue doing it. So it's helping someone to understand where they are, take a step back, remove the shame from it, do things before they put themselves on dating again so that they're stronger, a different self that shows up, and then very specific guidance along the dating process. So as inevitably things don't go perfectly or fears come up, how do we deal with it when it happens so that you can have a new experience and based on that new experience, have a new reality?
Mm-hmm. And I guess for a lot of people, when they've reached a challenging point in a relationship or they have an argument or whatever else, I guess part of their brain is thinking, oh gosh, this is how my ex-partner used to deal with it. And then there's almost a surprise when the new partner deals with it differently. Trying to cope with those things. And I think one of the hardest things to know, I guess, unless you believe that there's one person on the planet for one person on the planet and we're somehow this fate and we're going to find each other. If generally you believe that there's 4 billion men, 4 billion women,
yeah,
we might connect with a number that we might meet, a number that we might not meet. How do you know when you've chosen the right person or whether you should keep looking? That sounds very
simple. It's a great question, because I think that there's a survey that was done in the US. Mm-hmm. And I think 66% of people share that they have this idea, this belief that there's the one human being out of 8 billion people on the planet that is the perfect, ideal, unique match for you, which I don't agree with. I mean, I respect people who think that way. I just think it's as absurd as someone who is talking about there's 1 trillion galaxies, the latest estimations, you know, in each galaxy with, yeah, I mean, billions of solar systems. Thinking, are we the only planet with life in the universe? Like, absolutely not. We haven't found it, but I can tell you that it's not true. Yeah. You know, so it's the same thing. So how do you know? Well, the first thing is if one takes the view that there's not just one person that's the right fit, and that even the right fit is going to have things that don't necessarily go. I mean, like studied by the Gottmans, you know, John Gottman and his group show that in the best of cases, in longitudinal studies, couples who are the best couples have at least 10 irreconcilable differences. This is not the worst couples, the best couples, you know? I see it black and you see it white. I mean, that's it. Now, what are those things? It matters, you know? There's certain things that are more important than others. So the way you recognize that someone is the right fit is, first of all, you feel happy with yourself. Because if you're not happy with yourself, then that evaluation balance is not going to be calibrated properly. Mm. You know, so if you're happy with yourself, if you've reached a point in your life where things are not perfect, but you feel like you have a good life and you're not seeking someone to fill a massive void in your heart, but to want to expand on something that's already good, that's already the first place to make that decision. Because I think if you don't have that, if you don't reach that spot, and again, I'm not talking about perfection, because you can work on yourself endlessly and never reach that, that pinnacle. but if you're in a space in your life where you feel you've done some work, you feel happy with yourself, then you really have to find out what's most important to you. There's this researcher called Taita Shiro that talks about 3 wishes, you know? And he talks about how you can mathematically X yourself out of the dating pool by having too many wishes. And it's not for me to say how, I mean, what you should go for or not. It's just, for example, he sets the example. If you're in the US and you say, well, I want a tall man, and tall man for me is 6'2", that's eliminating 93% of men in the first wish.
Yeah.
You know, if on top of that, there's a specific income, you might be mathematically Xing yourself out just in the first 2 wishes. So how do you figure out your values? And that's part of the work I do, helping someone find out what their values are, so they understand based on their own values if the person in front of them has a chance. So that's part of it. And there's going to be more of a just a heartfelt, intuitive sense. Do I feel seen by this human being? Does this person support me? Does this person want to build a life with me? Are they fun to be around? I mean, if I was stranded on a desert island with this human, would I have a bad time or good? Like, imagine that you're traveling and your flight gets delayed and you're stuck in the city for 5 more hours. If you're with the kind of person that's the right person for you, it's not maybe the most fun experience, but it's not a bad experience.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right?
Because you're together. Mm-hmm. If you're with the wrong person, then 5 minutes can feel like an eternity, right?
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
But I think it really comes out, like, if you really boil it down, besides the feeling and the other things, that, I mean, the shared values, it's going to be, how does the person deal with conflict? Person, when something's brought up, and there's going to be millions of things that are brought up in the course of a multi-year relationship, mm-hmm. That are not working, does the person... Is a person kind, empathetic? Are they trying to figure out things with you, or are they mostly telling you what you're doing wrong? I mean, like that. And that's what also the studies show, you know, the people who make it have at least 5-to-1 positive to negative ratios in conflict, you know? So if you see a couple fight and they're basically more of a 5-to-1 negative, I mean, they're not going to last. So yeah. Those are some ideas.
No, I like that. And how important is sex and physical intimacy shown to be? Are couples with a fulfilling or happy sex life more likely to stay together? Where does that feature in them?
I think that in a romantic relationship, it's not just sex. It's that feeling of connection, intimacy, which is, I mean, can go in many different ways, yeah. And attraction are important. Mm-hmm. They are not the only important thing or even the most important thing, but the difference between that and not that is a friendship or a sisterhood. You know, you have a sister and a brother. I mean, yeah. They can love themselves deeply, but there's no element of that, mm-hmm. You know? Hopefully.
You know? Well, yes. Exactly.
But with another human being that you're connecting with, that you're going to spend so many hours of your life with, there's a part of you that wants that connection, that spark, that intimacy. And I think that not having that obviously leads people to do things that are not good for the relationship sometimes. I mean, I'm not justifying it, but that's why a lot of people go out and find something else. It's not even, they want to feel more alive. If you don't have that element, the feeling of aliveness and connection isn't as strong. So it's something to cultivate and something to look at. In this society, sometimes it's something that's more valued than maybe I think it should, in the sense that some people are in relationships right now purely for that reason, and they're trying to extend it as long as possible, and they're not able to because there's nothing else there to really sustain it. But the sex is great.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's also the couples, you know. I mean, we're cool, but there's no passion. So I think it's an important element. And the notion that you could be with somebody for 50 years and that's not going to fade or move in some way if you don't do something active about it, I mean, also it's crazy. So how do you cultivate the newness in the relationship, the exploration of new ideas, the not thinking that you know the person 100%, like you never know the person 100%. So how do you maintain those conversations and how you have that? I mean, Esther Perel talks a lot about it, how the right balance between closeness and distance, right? Mm-hmm. So that it's not taken for granted. So you take a little bit of time, you can see that person from a distance, you know, whether it's taking a trip on your own or whether that's something that you build into the relationship, so that there's still element of freshness and newness and not just, okay, I guess we're seeing each other again because we sleep together.
The one of the things that I really love on your website are the photographs of happy people yeah. have found their partner and they're happy, and some of the testimonials they're very moving, they're very emotional. Without betraying any confidences, are there a couple of positive stories you could share about people that maybe were in a difficult place and they did find the right person?
Yeah, I mean, a few come to mind. There's one that I was writing about it the other day that I can think of right now. There's this woman, and she's on my website. Ashley is her name. Mm-hmm. And she'd gone through a really painful experience. She was in what she determined at the time was the love of my life. She found the person. They were madly in love. He's a soldier. He gets deployed to Iraq. And then lo and behold, he gets that knock on the door with a flag, you know, telling her that he's gone. And when that happened, she was so crushed, partly because, I mean, it's something that at very young, I mean, being a widow in her early 30s is something nobody expects. Also, because if you lose someone that's okay partner, but that person was really meaningful to her, best friends, you know? So she had built up in her mind, subconsciously, this idea that finding someone would be betraying him. She wasn't conscious of it, but she went through a bunch of relationships that were very painful. You know, when we started working together, she just ended something that was painful with someone who was far less than what she'd hoped for. And I remember, because sometimes you have this experience when you're helping someone and it's a brief moment of grace and something, you can see the light come back into that person's eyes and she just got it. We were talking about how the love that she experienced in her mind is something that's going to be replaced with something else. And I said, what if it's not replaced? What if it's in addition to? What if this love that you experience is going to be the beacon that's going to allow you to find that same frequency? And almost like this person is going to, this soul is going to help you connect to this other person, because what does he want for you? And we went through this whole thing. It was maybe an hour and a half of conversation. And the very next morning, she lived in Austin. She went to Whole Foods. And somebody stops her, first time in her life this ever happened, saying, you look so radiant, you're so beautiful. It wasn't the guy she ended up being with, but just that awareness that from opening up a little bit of a window, a new expression of her, no changing clothes, no losing of weight, no makeup, like just that in the morning in jogging pants, you know? So a little later, she had a friend that been witnessing her growth transformation. She saw the change in aliveness, and she said, I want much more than friendship. Like, let's test this. And she was a little reluctant. They're married, they live in Hawaii, they have two beautiful children. But experiences like that are so rewarding, because you never know when the right insight at the right time is going to help someone do things differently going forward. And that's really what motivates me to do things this day and age. You know, another example that comes to mind is, I worked with someone a couple of years ago, and she was in her 60s, other end of the spectrum, you know, and she was having breast cancer for the second time before we worked together. And as she was having breast cancer for the second time, she got divorced. So it was like the worst time of her life. You know, she ended at the, she got divorced, entered a relationship that was okay, but became a little addictive. And then when she came to me, she's almost like she was starting to lose hope. And to help someone at that age to go at it again, and she found an amazing guy. She loves cycling. So she found a guy younger than her. He's into bicycles. They've been together for now a year. She has a promise ring. I'm not sure if they'll get married or not, but just that they want to spend their lives together. Yeah. And to have someone who lost hope in this to come back and say, hey, she said something along the lines of, I feel like I'm starting again, which is incredible. You know, starting again at 65, that's beautiful.
It must feel incredibly uplifting to be a big part of that, of helping people literally change their lives. But there must also be times when initially you hear some challenging stories, perhaps people have been through trauma and are struggling to get past it. How do you look after yourself? How do you make sure that your mental well-being remains robust?
Sure. I mean, it's a great question. I'm someone that if I don't do the things I do, my natural state would be to go towards depression. So the things that I do that help me is I exercise every single day, not minus one. And I'm in nature every single day. I live close to a nature preserve. So every morning I wake up and I see the sun come out as I go up and down a mountain twice. I ground myself and I meditate in front of a river. I have a cold plunge that I don't use as often as I used to, but at least once a day I go into the cold plunge, which helps me to just, after I exit that space, have more more excitement. I take lots of supplements that are helpful for me, you know? And I'm suggesting in any way anyone should do this, but I know given time and what I've tested, things, omega-3 is a must for me every day. I mean, a lack of omega-3 has been proven to increase incidence of depression. Vitamin D is something I take every single day because my DNA doesn't produce vitamin D from the sun. Mm-hmm. Same thing, my DNA. And this is, I talked to a PhD who evaluated my DNA and say, hey, one of the challenges basically right now is you're not very good at synthesizing serotonin. So I take a precursor to serotonin almost daily, which is 5-HTP. So there's a few things I do, from the supplements to my eating habits. I very little sugar. and very little processed grains, because I know that also what the moments when I've done it, it impacts my ability to, I mean, my just my ups and downs emotionally. So that's something that I do. Journaling is really, really helpful. I don't do it daily, but when I feel really overwhelmed, mm-hmm. I just let it out completely. You know, I put everything on paper and then I just move the page. You know, Brené Brown talks about a shitty first draft. And then you can come back and say, okay, even by the end of that journaling, sometimes I already come up with good ideas, but I start with something dark and negative, and then I come up into the other. So all those things are breathing also is something mm-hmm. super helpful, you know, conscious breathing. 4-7-8 would be one of the that I practice the most. I measure a lot of things with my little Oura ring, you know, my stress level throughout the day, my movement, my sleep habits. I think if people listening to this right now, they're having a hard time in life. If you only change one thing, and that is how you sleep, that will change your life. Because it's really, really hard to be positive and to not have things hit you harder than they should, especially in this world that we're facing right now, if you're sleep deprived. So that's something that I take very seriously, my sleep. So the combination of those things makes it where I have a lot of buffers right now to feel equipped to be able to bring my best self. But I'm a human being and I live life and there's disappointments. So there's every now and then I need more. I mean, so I mean, therapy has been incredibly helpful. I'm not in therapy right now, but I've taken therapy multiple times in life, you know, and I've been coached by people who are very helpful in terms of helping me figure out my own stuff. I have a beautiful experience of going to what I call a trauma camp. 2 years ago with a very gifted therapist. It was like four men and this person and me for 6 days, just working out things from childhood, you know? So all those things help inform basically how I do things. And also when I connect with someone, I'm really conscious of, and that's why I have conversations with every single person I work with. I don't have somebody else having those intakes. Mm-hmm. There's a difference between coaching and therapy, and I'm not a therapist. I mean, I understand a lot of my psychology, but it's not what I do. So if somebody comes from a place that really needs therapy, I'll suggest that before I work with them. Because the last thing I want to do is re-traumatize them by asking them to do things that they're not ready for, you know, or they haven't healed from. So that's also something that's really powerful and something that's really called for in the coaching industry. I think because coaching is a lucrative industry and there's a sense that I should be able to help anyone. Many people take any person without them having a backup or that person having gone through the right approach. Mm-hmm. So it's really important to make sure that the person that you're working with is really a coaching client versus a trauma client that needs to be handled by someone else.
Yeah, and for people that are looking for coaches, I would say the biggest thing on your website that got me was the testimonials. So if people that work with somebody that have good things to say about them, that's, if people have no testimonials on their websites, maybe if you don't know anybody that's been to see them and they're promising results in a, we can guarantee results in 28 days, and it's not like, or one session, or you think, no, that's not the word. The final question, so I don't take your entire day.
No worries.
And maybe it's a harder one, really, but do you have a plan or a vision for the future? What do you feel the next maybe 5 or 10 years might bring for you?
Great question. I'm getting close to publishing some findings. I've been doing this research. Fabulous. Specifically about dating for women in midlife, gathering lots of data points right now that make it very, very clear that this is a specific challenge. It's not just imagination. It's not just so low self-esteem or somebody not putting themselves out there enough. There's real legitimate reasons why this is a challenge. So that's part of it, basically publishing that research and honing in more on that. I'm very focused these days on neuroscience. So I've been learning more and more and more to apply in my life, but also help my clients through this. So I see myself really growing more and more into that because I see it as the only way to help people long term is to really understand how their nervous system and brain works. Everything else is just, a band-aid if that's not handled properly. So that's much more of my focus these days. Trauma-informed, neuroscience-based work. And seeing what else develops, you know, in terms of I'm creating different kinds of videos right now than before. So I'm having fun with that. It's not always easy, but it's fun. I'm doing a lot more of this. Like I just started this year doing the podcast stuff and that's been really enjoyable. So I'm sure something good will come. I have someone right now who, a friend of mine, I'm from Mexico, but I've never actually shared any of my work in Mexico. So she's getting me right now, about to start putting me into podcasts in Mexico. Oh, so I think that's something that will develop, you know, I mean, programs perhaps there in Latin America and stuff. So that, I'm excited about that because it's part of the world that I needs this work. It's my blood. And just for leaving here, I've not been doing it. So I'm excited about that too.
Mm. Just don't forget that there's only 24 hours in each day.
Yeah,
sure you do have some time to go on vacation and yeah,
for sure.
Thank you so much for your time. I'll put lots of links into the notes, and people should really look at your website and absolutely go and look at the videos because there's so much there that's you give away so much for free, which I think is very very genuine, very honest of you. So well, no, thank you for what you're doing. I think it's super important, and yeah, I look forward to seeing how life progresses for you.
Thank you very much for having me here. I really enjoy this conversation. I mean, as I said, I've been doing lots of podcasts, and I really enjoy when someone has this nuanced approach and is insightful and heartfelt, and it just means the world to me. So I really appreciate your invitation.
Oh, thank you.